Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeff Charlotte is our guest this hour. Jeff has written a series of essays that are absolutely fascinating and beautifully written. And the book in which these essays are is Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. Jeff, you'll recall, is also the author of the bestseller, The Family. That's the last time we interviewed him, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. And that book described the influence of Christian fundamentalism at the highest levels of American policymaking and power. He's also author of C Street. He is Mellon Assistant Professor of English at Dartmouth, Professor of Nonfiction, contributing editor for Harper's Magazine and Rolling Stone. He spent a year investigating the variety of religious experience in America, which became a book, Killing the Buddha, published in 2004. He has written for many, many publications, is a frequent guest on The Rachel Maddow Show and NPR's Fresh Air, describes himself as a religious voyeur. The book is a collection of 13 absolutely fascinating essays. And so we have a lot, including some people you thought, why didn't I know about this person? Why didn't I know about this movement? It'll be interesting to find out how he got some of these stories, which include, and I think we'll start with her, a Holocaust survivor, a Yiddish novelist and poet who not very many people know about, who has written so movingly about the Holocaust directly, the behind-the-scenes hero of independent music who became the local linchpin of what comes closest to a media monopoly, Clear Channel Communications. We will talk about that. We'll talk about his time. He spent almost a year meeting with Dr. Cornel West, who's a fascinating guy. And also, this huge movement, which I hate to admit I don't know about things, but that's why I do a talk show. This huge movement that is getting young people to become involved with Jesus. But the way that this is all happening, it's a battle cry movement, it's huge in this country. It's drawing all kinds of very young people. And Jeff highlights that as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him and hearing some amazing stories. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org for you to join our conversation. And Jeff, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Good to be with you again.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I just love this book. You are just, you pinpoint the most fascinating people and their important stories, and you are one gifted writer. I just want to compliment you because you're very good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know where to start, so I think I want to start with a woman that you first met when you learned about her after you took a job at the National Yiddish Book Center in Amherst. And it's a woman we should all know about. The work she did was absolutely extraordinary, and she's really in the back pages of history. We just don't know very much about Ms. Rosenfarb.
Yeah, Hava Rosenfarb. And I make the case that she is maybe one of the most important novelists of the Holocaust. Maybe I might even go so far as to say the most important. She was also the last great Yiddish writer alive. And unfortunately, she died literally the day before this book went to press.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I was doing my final fact-checking, and I wanted to make sure I got some dates right, and it had just been announced, and I discovered that she had died. Hava Rosenfarb, and the book is called, her book that I write about is called Der Baum von Leben, or The Tree of Life, which was this great, originally three-volume Yiddish chronicle of life in the Łódź ghetto in Poland, where she had lived. And very much, there's almost a sort of a sociological element to it, because she decided to chronicle everything. And she was this human being of unbelievable empathy. I mean, such empathy that she had empathy with very dark characters as well. And there's nothing sweet or saccharine or sentimental about this book. It is the fullest portrait of life under extreme duress, the extreme duress of the ghetto, that I've ever come across in years of reading about that period.
Why don't we know more about her?
Well, she wrote in Yiddish.
That could be a problem.
Really, that could be a problem. And there's really only one writer, Yiddish writer, most people know, Isaac Bashevis Singer. Maybe some people know Shalom Aleichem, from whose Tevye Tales, Fiddler on the Roof, was based, although very loosely based. The funny thing about I.B. Singer, too, is I think he's a wonderful writer, but he's not in any way representative of Yiddish literature. Hava is much more representative. And she was the last great one. There are no more after her. And there probably won't be any more. Yiddish was this language, for listeners out there aren't familiar with. Hebrew is the sort of, at that time, was a religious language only. Yiddish was the language of Eastern European Jewry. So there's that. There's the fact that she's a woman in the world of Yiddish literature, which is very sexist. She came to Canada. She the novel was translated. It was quite badly translated, so you can read it in English. The translation's not great. It's still worth it. And then the book was just sort of warehoused. It was shelved, and no one paid attention. No one had paid attention to her for years until I started going up to Montreal, where she lived, and spending time with her and doing these interviews. And it is a tragedy, but you know, buy my book, Sweet Heaven, When I Die, but if you have to choose one, go buy her book first, The Tree of Life, which is actually published by University of Wisconsin Press. So
oh, it is.
A local angle.
Oh,
yeah.
My. We should do a whole show on that. That would be an interesting program.
I think it would be great. I mean, and there's because she was such a – you know, part of the reason I wanted to write about her, all the characters in this book to me embody – they go back to something that Cornel West, one of the other subjects in the book, describes. And Cornel West, this great African-American philosopher, theologian, defines as the essential human dignity, the ability to contradict what is. Hmm. The first step is saying no. And writing this great novel of life in the Holocaust was, in her way, an ability to contradict the death sentence that she'd been given. And so I think she, maybe more than anyone else, exemplifies that.
Tell me how she saved her mother.
The story she tells, and I'll come back to why I frame it that way. The story she tells is that she and her sisters and her mother had been sent to Auschwitz. She went through a number of concentration camps. They're coming to the sort of the infamous line, at the end of which was Mengele. And he says, you know, you go this way for instant extermination, and you go this way for labor. And if you're too old, you're not going that way. And they come before Mengele, and, you know, he asks about how old the mother is. And Hava just instantly lied and shaved years off her life. And so he decided... Mengele decided that she could survive. The reason I frame it with some question, and I think Hava would say this too, is one of the things I discovered working years ago at the Yiddish Book Center, people would send me their Holocaust memoirs. There's a sense in which everybody met Mengele because he's become this sort of kind of the figure that represents all this thing. Of course, there was any number of awful Nazi monsters doing this, and in her memory it's Mengele, and it may well be, because her memory was right up to the very end astonishing, but of course we can't document that.
And she also mentions people who were capable of acts of human kindness, small acts but incredibly important acts.
In fact, it was a German concentration camp guard that in some ways enabled her survival, not just as a human being but as a writer. A man who would, he was pressed into service doing this. This was not work he wanted to do. And he had a soft spot for her mother, and he would slip things to the prisoners and, you know, sometimes a newspaper, so they could find out what was going on in the world, if there was hope. Once he saved her physical self by giving her just a little folded up slip, because it was freezing and they were wearing nothing. And it was just a little extra layer that may have made the difference. And then one time he gave her a pencil and she hid it in her shoe, and she took it back to the barracks, and she would lie. She had a top bunk, and she would write with her pencil on the ceiling, on the wooden ceiling. She would write poems, and she would memorize these poems once the pencil was worn down to a nub. And when she survived, when she was in Canada, that became her first book of published poems, was her memorized poems that she'd originally written with the pencil this man had given her.
I'm so glad you included her, and we will do a show on her. It's It's quite a story, and I agree with you. Buy your book and buy her book at the same time.
Buy hers first.
If you buy hers first.
Few cents left over, you can buy Sweet Heaven When I Die.
Okay. But yours is worth buying as well. You mentioned Dr. Cornel West, your chapter on him, and I guess you were with him for about a year, visiting him every now and then. Let's start with the death shudder that he felt when he was a very young guy, and it seems to have a prominent place in his whole life.
Yeah, and very underappreciated. That story began, I write a lot for Rolling Stone magazine, and my editor had said, let's do a story about Cornel West, who was in the news actually lately because he's critical of Obama.
Yes.
And people are sort of surprised by this. And this was, I first began talking to Cornel right before the 2008 election. He was critical then, even when he was campaigning for Obama. That's what he sees his place as. He says, look, we speak truth to power, and just because maybe whoever we think is our side is in doesn't mean we stop that. That's our job as intellectuals, as thinkers, as writers, as citizens, as human beings. So this editor says, why don't you go down and talk to Cornel West? And to be honest, I didn't want to because I thought I knew the story. He's such a famous man. But I went down and I had a conversation with him. And through a sort of odd set of circumstances of common books we had read and things like that, we got beyond some of the sort of the normal shuffle that you have when you interview someone, a celebrity. And we began talking about what he described as the death shudders, his death shudders that he had experienced ever since he was a little boy. He was an incredibly talented, very angry young man as a child, gifted in all ways, off the charts intellectually, athlete, but a bitter, angry man. And he had a real sense of mortality. That the end is going to come. Just that ordinary thing that maybe as you get older we all grasp, but young people usually don't. And he understood that this was not a thing to be feared, but a very valuable understanding that if you understand that you're going to die, as he puts it, that's a statement that allows you to live. And that became the cornerstone of so much of his writing. And once I understood that about him and saw that that really hadn't been represented in the kind of purely political stories about his work, I thought there's really another tale to tell here about a much deeper vein of thought.
You spend some time talking about the way he dresses, and he wears essentially the same thing every day, this black suit. His suit is his armor, he says. What is it about the way he dresses?
It's a black three-piece suit with 25-carat Ethiopian gold cufflinks with the shape of Africa on them. He wears this every day. He's got a whole bunch of them, tailor-made. He's a stylish man, and he actually takes – it's funny because he does take a lot of criticism from that, and he tends to take criticism from that from a certain kind of sort of white liberal or centrist who thinks that this reveals vanity or phoniness. And that statement on their part reveals a kind of a deep ignorance about the history of African-American life. And to understand that when he wears that to him is it's tribute to the great jazzmen who are his heroes like Duke Ellington, also the preachers like Daddy King. Martin Luther King's father was known as Daddy King, and to his great hero W.E.B. Du Bois. These men who understood that in a system that dehumanizes you, that looks at you less inhuman as America has so long for African Americans. Well, you've got to contradict what is. You assert your dignity. And that was, to me, was just a very powerful thing. But then there's an even deeper layer to that. He describes himself as a bluesman, and he thinks about blues and jazz. But he doesn't limit it to just what we know as blues and jazz music. For instance, he describes the great Russian writer Chekhov as one of his favorite bluesmen. And to him, the black suit is also reminiscent of Masha and the play Three Sisters. It's a sense of mourning. It's that death shudder. You wear the black suit to remind yourself always that death is out there and that you must not act as if you're going to live forever.
Mm. You have a wonderful little some paragraphs about what you find on his bookshelf, which I always find interesting what people are reading. This guy is a reader. He's a reader.
He really is, yeah. And in fact, that was actually the sort of the breakthrough. I write for Rolling Stone, but I'm very lucky in that I almost never write about celebrities. There's a very special talent. There are writers who can do that, who can, you know, get the telling detail. But that's not what I do. I'd rather sit and talk with a person for a long time. And I didn't know how I was going to – because Cornell does have a shtick, just like anybody who's been interviewed many, many times. And we ended up sort of breaking through, actually, through another essay in this book that I'd originally published in a small Southern literary magazine called Oxford American. And the essay was about a white banjo player from the 1920s named Doc Boggs. And Cornell had read it, how he had found this journal.
Oh, next, one day isn't that something?
He read it and he recognized in Doc Boggs, this musician, something akin to his own kind of thinking. And suddenly we were off and we're having this conversation. And that's just exactly how he reads. He's a man who sleeps 3 hours a night and he reads and he reads and he reads and he reads everything. I've never encountered anyone better read than he is, certainly in philosophy and theology, African American history and culture and so on, but also Russian literature. He's one of the most deeply read men you'll find in Russian literature and American literature. The fact that he would know this obscure and racist white musician from the 1920s, Doc Boggs, the fact that he would know almost any contemporary fiction that you'd read, he reads and he reads and he reads. And to me, those characters, those people who are consumed like that, are the most exciting people to write about.
Are you the same? Do you read and read and read?
I try, but I do, but I can't read like Cornell. I don't think anybody can. I mean,
you like to sleep. Even,
I do like to sleep.
Right,
I
mean,
there's one.
Too.
at a certain point, I don't think Cornell does. At a certain point, one of his colleagues, one of his many proteges, a guy named Eddie Glaude, who's a great scholar himself, tells of a story of being on the road with Cornell and Tavis Smiley, the talk show host, who's a great friend of Cornell's. And Tavis Smiley had come out with this new book, a memoir. And they had done an event that night. They'd been out late, you know, talking and having dinner. They're heading to bed around 2 a.m. And they've got to get on. They got to get up out of the hotel at 7 in the next morning. They get out there, they're groggy, they're headed to the airport, and Cornell says, "Brother Tavis, let's talk about this book," because he's read it.
He's read the book in that night. Oh, my. And one final thing on him before we go on to Battle Cry, which is an incredible story in the book, because they are doing this thing, pinpointing Obama and challenging Obama. You write, West despised candidate Obama's historic Philadelphia speech on race. It was weak, man, weak, in which the candidate described slavery as America's original sin. I really loved that speech. I thought it was a beautiful speech. Why did he call it weak?
I did, too. It moved me to tears. I mean, and on the practical level, on the literal level, he says, because Obama got it wrong, America's original sin was not slavery. America's original sin was genocide, the destruction of the Native Americans. And that's more than a kind of politically correct, you know, correction to the chain of history. He says that's absolutely essential to understanding democracy. He says, look, when we look at American democracy, we have to understand that it has an intimate relationship to genocide. What enabled America to be this nation where people could come from Europe and could find land, people who had been peasants, who had been serfs, could come and find space? The extermination, the elimination, the removal of the people that were already there. And that doesn't invalidate democracy. You have to understand, West is a very Christian thinker, so he thinks in terms of original sin. He says right there at the root of democracy is an original sin. And I think some of us might want to have a more optimistic view of democracy, but we have to wrestle with that. And I think when he challenged Obama, he challenged that, and he had challenged the sense of American exceptionalism that we just, you know, basically we're perfect. We made a few mistakes, and if we correct those mistakes, onwards and upwards. I think he's much more like Hava Rosenfarb, which is that we never forget.
Mm. Our guest this hour is Jeff Charlotte, and his book is Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. It's a series of 13 essays, each as compelling as the next. Jeff is the best-selling author of The Family and C Street. We talked to him about The Family. It was a big book in this country. Co-author of Killing the Buddha, contributing editor to Rolling Stone and Harper's, teaches creative nonfiction at Dartmouth College. And this may be a difficult show to call into. Maybe some of you have had a chance to read this splendid book, or you read, I know many of you, The Family, because we're going to go from story to story to story. But feel free to comment on the stories that have already been told as we move to the new stories. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. 8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. We're going to move on to this huge youth movement that I didn't know very much about at all. Battle Cry, Growing a New Hardcore for American Fundamentalism. So we'll go to that, and we'll talk about Clear Channel, and we'll talk about his old girlfriend and much more coming up. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll go to your phone calls momentarily. We'll do another story here and then start taking your calls, which can refer to other stories you've heard. 800-486-8655. But we must go to Ron Luce, Commander-in-Chief of Battle Cry. Jeff says, the most furious youth crusade since young sinners in the hands of an angry God flog themselves with shame in 18th century New England. Nearly three centuries later, these teens are about to be branded by God. Luce says, when you enlist in the military, there's a code of honor, same as being a follower of Christ. The code requires a wartime mentality, a survival orientation, and a readiness to face real enemies. This is a compelling essay. I had no idea this movement was as large as it was. I didn't know very much about it at all, to tell you the truth, Jeff.
I think it sort of escapes a lot of notice because most people, if they encounter it all, see it as, oh, there's a three-day Christian rock concert at the local arena. And, you know, Christian rock concert, that's fine. Maybe it's your thing. Maybe it's not. They're not paying attention to what's going on in this. And, you know, I've been reporting about fundamentalism and evangelicalism, and they should be distinguished and not the same thing, for 10 years, and written two books about it, and seen some good and some bad and some ugly. And I've never seen anything like this. And a lot of people, when they talk about the Christian right, like to use what I call the F word, fascism. I don't. I don't think fascism is a particularly – I don't think the Christian right is fascist. It's something else. This is the closest thing to fascism I've ever encountered in the United States. And maybe if I can give like a short paragraph to give you
– please do.
Put you in the scene. This is what's going on in the stadium when a battle cry comes to your town. And they are coming to your town. This is not – you know, sometimes folks in Wisconsin like to maybe – like where I am in New Hampshire, like to dismiss this as a Southern thing. And it's an all-over thing. Luce ends his rallies with a figurative dismemberment that evokes nothing so much as slasher porn, a woman's body cut to pieces in a shower. Luce thinks he's taking it from the Book of Judges, the story of a man who, surrounded by enemies, gives up his concubine to be raped to death. In the morning, he hacks her body into 12 pieces and sends one to each of the tribes of Israel, a warning, Luce believes, of the fate of the ungodly. Luce resurrects this warning by killing a mannequin, each part labeled with a sin of secularism. As he stokes the kids into a chant that's not frenzied but determined, cut up the concubine, cut up the concubine. Luce dispatches the pieces into the crowd. In Cleveland, one sensible 14-year-old boy snorts at the sight of a girl hugging her catch, a naked torso labeled porn. Imagine carrying that home, he whispers. Thousands of kids do. They shriek for the prize of the head, still on offer.
Oh, my gosh. Ah, that's all I can say. Ah, in what, in his mind, in his followers' mind, might we determine is ungodly?
Well, you and me, to begin with, we're what he calls cultural terrorists.
Uh-oh.
Just lest that be misunderstood as a metaphor, he likes to say, this is not a metaphor. Those of us in the secular media are terrorists doing, as he says, to America, just what Al-Qaeda did. He makes no distinction. There's a sense that I write about this in which his language almost sort of evokes Allen Ginsberg's famous beat poem, Howl.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of, and there's a sort of howling rage. He actually mimics some of that language, except turning it in this other direction. And really doing it very effectively, because as you know, sort of horrifying as what I just read you is,
yes.
You know, it's spectacle. It happens in the stadium. We all know, you know, kids can go to a horror show and go home and forget it. And he knows that too. So the millions of kids who go to his rallies, he sees as just a recruiting pool from which he's drawn over 70,000 kids who've gone through training, a year or more of training at his Honor Academy in East Texas, where they're visited by leading political figures, leading figures of the Christian right. They go through this almost paramilitary training that some former members allege is they're kept awake for days on end. They, you know, are forced to eat horrible things, things like that. But they're also trained in media. Quirky little detail is that his chief of media is one of the guys who created VH1's Behind the Music and then became born again and became very conservative and saw it as his mission to train these Christian warriors, as they see themselves, to – and this is their language. This is not my language. To infiltrate secular media, to bore from within and destroy. I mean, their language is so over the top that sometimes you just want to giggle. But then you spend time with these kids whose lives are being shaped and warped and destroyed by this. And it's not so funny.
And they're pretty young. You just mentioned the 14-year-old in the audience. A lot of these people who are attracted and go through the training are quite young.
Well, to go to the Honor Academy, you're out of high school. Some people go between high school and college. Some people take time off from college. The most devoted just go there, and they do a distance education degree through Jerry Falwell's Liberty University. And so what I wanted to do – I mean, I went to these rallies, and I traveled around with Luz. But I wanted to go down to this Honor Academy and spend time with these students, many of whom are really just – quite liked. And in fact, that's why this story is in some ways – that's why it fits in this book, because I should say, you know, I spent 10 years writing about fundamentalism. Everything in this book is something that I wrote during that period as a way to keep myself sane while I was immersed in this authoritarian subculture. Even this story, because, you know, I found people who were embodying that Cornel Westian idea of the ability to contradict what is. These young people with whom I go to a hell house. This is like a Christian conservative haunted house where instead of, you know, vampires, actors pretending to be gay men jump out of the shadows. I'm not making that up. That's actually what happens there. It's a terribly bigoted place. And I go with these three young people. Sexual abstinence is a big part of it. And, you know, the idea of sex as actually evil is this kind of idea of it. But as they get away from campus, they start reverting to their 19, their 20-year-old selves, flirting with one another, telling stories about the life they led before they got there. And they become just these wonderful young people who are trying to find meaning in the world. And you almost understand why they are there. That, in a sense, they've looked at the world that was on offer to them and this kind of apolitical, passionless world, and it was empty. Battle Cry rushed in to fill that gap. And I think that's tragic, but I think it's something that you can understand and you can see the humanity in them.
It must have been so hard, though, to see the humanity in them and care about them and realize where they were and not want to, you know, get a nice big van and take them to Dartmouth.
I don't know if Dartmouth is a solution, but
wherever.
I didn't say that. I'm sitting here in the Dartmouth studio. You know, I did. I took my rental car and I took these kids to this hell house and the nearby town, and they were, you know, that was already a sketchy thing because there was men and women in the car. Ron Luce advises against that. That's pretty dangerous, he thinks. And we go through this thing and we go through this hell house. And I should say, you know, it's, you know, the people pretending to be gay men jumping out of the corner, a teenage girl getting raped because there's no prayer in her schools, things like this. And then you get to the end and there's an actor portraying Christ and he's being whipped. And there's, you know, blood splashing all over the place. And it's a very vivid, very realistic. And then we go through and there's one of the sort of the local missionaries and he's waiting for me because the Honor Academy is called ahead. They're not happy that I've taken their students and that they can't oversee this conversation. And so they've decided the time has come. There's only one thing to do, and that's to save my soul. So we sit down and we start going through scripture. And unfortunately, this young missionary is not well prepared. He wants to talk to me the story about Abraham and Isaac, but he can't remember where it is in the Bible, and I have to show it to him.
Oh, no.
So he finally pulls out his trump card and he says, you know that blood you saw when they were whipping the actor playing Jesus? And I said, yeah. And he says, that's real. That's real. We didn't fake it. And that, to him, prove something important. And I think it demonstrates something important, too, about the ways in which the mind can twist something, twist a story like the Christ story, which is a beautiful story and a tragic story, into something that is nothing but violence.
Yeah. You certainly must see a book in this one, don't you, in this whole chapter?
Battle Cry? No.
Don't you? Oh, I do.
For somebody out there, I'm putting it on the block. You can have it. I'd spent really 10 years sort of living with in archives on American fundamentalism, and you know, right before I really started putting this book together, or in that period, same period actually, I had been to Uganda, where I had been reporting on the so-called Kill the Gays movement, this attempt at genocide in Uganda that is linked to the American Christian right. And I put this book together in a way as to sort of look for these stories that had sustained me, and as my way of moving on. I've done my time on that subject. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is not – I don't want people to get the wrong impression. There's a lot of – I mean, that's part of why I included it, because I like those young people who resist that in this story. There's lots of wonderful people within American fundamentalism, people who understand the idea of liberty of conscience, the Roger Williams idea that, you know, that gives birth to the First Amendment, to understand that distinction and so on. But I don't think I want to spend any more time with the Ron Luces of the world and their cut up mannequins. And
yeah. And ooh, cries. What a story. Ooh, that was going to stay with me. Let's go to some phone calls. Lena, is it, from Lyons? Hi, Lena. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead.
Oh, my name's Glenna.
Oh, Glenna. Hi, Glenna.
Hi. I'm really happy that I get to get on the show and give this comment, because I really enjoyed listening to Tavis Smiley on his show when he on public television, and I've seen Cornel West on Bill Maher many times. I know he's a very intelligent, well-educated person, as well as Tavis Smiley, and I also enjoy, or sometimes enjoy, listening to Smiley and West if I happen to be in the Chicago Public Radio area on Sundays. Now, I should say I'm a 70-year-old white woman. And I have to say, some of the comments that I've heard the two of them make about the president, if they don't like him, that's one thing. But I think they've been really rude and disrespectful towards him. And also, I think that they're very racist in a way against white people. And I've heard the two of them, or not the two of them, but I've heard Cornel West, when he had some of those rallies about maybe a month or so ago, I listened to the show, and it was like a rally. It might have been like Black History or something like that. And it just gets me when the two of them get together. It seems as though they get into that language that's not their educated language that I know that they can speak. And it seems as though when they get together, or maybe not Tavis, but when Cornel West gets together with his rallies, and it seems as though he talks down to the black people that are at his rallies, as though he doesn't think that they can understand him if he speaks in a well-educated way.
All right, let's get a response. Jeff?
I think, first of all, you're probably right that they've been disrespectful of the president. I think, on the one hand, you can make a case for that, which is, you know, as Cornel West says, I'd rather be in the crack house than in the White House. That's not... you know, this was a famous essay, The Responsibility of Intellectuals. The responsibility of intellectuals is not to be helping power. It's to be challenging power. So he would say that. And then I would also add, here I am at Dartmouth. Cornel West is a Princeton professor. You know, the Ivy League is not known for its great humility. That's not one of its strong suits. And what I found sort of distressing about this is everyone says, you know, you can – Cornel West was being egotistical. Being egotistical? Oh, the Ivy League professor. I don't believe it. It can't have happened. Of course he was. He's a man with an ego. He's an incredibly brilliant man. And in some ways that was sort of one of the stories – one of the things that I found so – fascinating about Cornel West and was underappreciated is that there's a tragic sense of him, not just in the death shudder, but in the way in which, as a young man in 1982, when he first published his first book called Prophesied Deliverance, and one of my favorites, he was poised to lead a movement that never came. And, you know, here was a guy who was the best and the brightest, the warmest, the most charismatic, anointed by those around him. And we forget in those early days, a lot of people thought Reagan is so far to the right. Finally, you know, after the long sort of dark 70s, we're going to have a revival of a progressive movement. And instead, that didn't happen. Instead, there was an ice age. And I think Cornel West was a man made for another time. And there's certainly bitterness that attends that. And I do find distressing the, I'll put it this way, the level of intolerance a lot of people are having at the display of ego from this person, as if we want, you know, there's the idea that Cornel West as an African-American should be above those things and has to be this saint for all of us. He's not that. And like all of us, he speaks many languages, like all the characters in this book. You know, I mean, I think that's what's so fascinating about spending time with people is you discover the different languages people speak. The language that you share with them may not be the only language in which they live their lives.
Thank you, Glenna, for the call. Here's an email from Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Are you familiar with the huge and growing numbers of Americans who consider themselves truly, sincerely spiritual, but do not ally themselves with institutional religions? More importantly, do you, Jeff, see anything emerging in the culture that might cure the cultural, spiritual starvation exemplified in your conversation from which this culture is suffering?
Well, the writer is referring to what sociologists call the sort of the block of American life called spiritual but not religious, which, to be honest, actually, I've always been skeptical of as a person who's been writing about religion. There's an awful lot of people who are spiritual but not religious, except that they are. It's just religious has become a dirty word for them. What religion means, what the word literally means, is the ties that bind. So if you're a human being and you get together with another human being and you start to make meaning out of the ways in which you have community, in which you have ritual, you're veering toward religion. And that, to me, is a deeper and more democratic term than spiritual, which on its own, certainly spirituality is important, but on its own evokes a certain kind of isolated individualism, a kind of, you know, it's the kind of, it's like the Whole Foods left, like because I shop at Whole Foods or one of these grocery markets and I buy organic and so on, that I'm somehow part of a movement, even though I'm not. So I think, but to sort of turn it around, because the second part of the question was, do I see any hope? And I said, yeah, I see lots of hope. I mean, there's always, this is a book, Sweet Heaven When I Die is a book of people who are displaying in different ways political imagination. And I mean political broadly, just the way I do religion, thinking about the ways in which we organize ourselves, live together, and so on. Those people are out there. They're not always the people that we hear about the most, but they're everywhere. They're us. They're everyday people. They're citizens when we engage in that. And I think the great challenge for us is to open our ears to these many languages that literal and spiritual and everything else that people speak, you know, the sort of the cacophony choir of American life. We don't live in a harmonious nature and thank God, gods, or whatever you want to thank for that, because we have many, many, many voices. Mm-hmm. Saying different things. That's democracy. Democracy, one of the stories in this book that I hope emerges is democracy is not all of us on the same page.
Yeah. Duane in Beaver Dam. Hi.
Hi. I'm a retired school teacher, and a few years ago I had a student who had run away from the Amish. Her name's Tora Bontrager, and she moved to New York City, and I believe she's writing a book about that. I was wondering if the guest is aware of her.
I'm not, but there is actually a chapter. It's funny you ask that. There is a chapter on a sort of a Jack Mennonite in this chapter. It's called "You Must Draw a Long Bead to Draw Shoot a Fish," and it emerged actually when a friend for an anthology said she wanted to do an anthology of people who had been raised half Jewish, and I'm a half Jew, whatever that means. But so my, I sort of told my story, but I told it through telling the story of a person who had come from the sort of the Mennonite world. Mennonites, much like the Amish, of Lancaster County in Pennsylvania. And her father had actually left, but she'd sort of grown up in its shadow. And she had left, but she couldn't quite leave. And she was always drawn back to that. And I think that's actually an incredibly powerful well from which to draw stories. I don't trust people who say that they can leave the past behind completely. I'm much more inclined. You may leave a community, you may leave an idea, you may leave a belief, but it's always there with you in the sense that a friend of mine, the novelist Peter Manceau, with whom I wrote my first book, describes he's I guess a lapsed Catholic, and he doesn't believe anymore. But he says, you know, for him, Catholicism is like a first language. It's the language you dream in. He dreams in Catholic, even though he doesn't believe in that anymore. And I think if you can find the space between those two discourses, you've got a great story.
Yeah. Would it be fair to say you're half Jewish and half kind of hillbilly?
yeah.
You have quite a combination.
I'm half Jewish, half hillbilly, raised by my hippie mother from the hillbilly side who took my sister and I to as many churches, ashrams, synagogues as she had friends. And her method, her spiritual method, was she followed the music. We went where she liked the music. So her friend Shersty sang in an Episcopalian choir, so we went there. Roger sang in a Methodist choir, so we went there. She liked the cheese at a monastery, so we went there. We went to an ashram. We would go all these places. You know, perhaps there's some connection between that upbringing and this sort of a array of eclectic stories. I guess I'm still thinking like that.
And you're trying to answer. You weren't really Jewish. You had to sort of discover what it meant to be Jewish, because I love the – when people were asking you in school what it meant to be Jewish, you didn't have a clue.
I didn't have a Jew. Yeah, I just said I didn't have a Jew. Boy, this is it's like a Woody Allen movie. I grew up in a small town called Scotia, New York, which is a wonderful place. Broad-mindedness is not its strongest suit. It was a very anti-Semitic little town. You know, I tell the story in the book of being in kindergarten and a teacher with good intentions asking me to explain Hanukkah. And I was raised by my mother and I knew my father, but I didn't know Judaism. She says, well, what's Judaism? So I just sort of, you know, search my head and I finally come up with Hanukkah. And, you know, the kids are looking at me kind of leery, as I would learn over the years. Their parents were not fond of the fact that there was a Jewish family in the community. And they said, well, what's Hanukkah? I said, well, it's like, you know, it's like Christmas, but I get presents for 8 days. And this is not a real – for children, this is not – and like, well, what kind of presents? And I was referring to gelt, you know, that little chocolate candy that's wrapped in gold coins. And I said, well, I get gold candy. It's gold coins. And this one kid says, you eat gold. And, you know, only looking back on this now that I sort of feel like, and thus, you know, the wheels of anti-Semitism take another turn.
Right.
The kid's gonna go back.
Right.
Jews eat gold and hoard all the presents.
Oh, no.
And you know, so the story is a little bit of becoming aware of, you know, obviously I ended up working at the Yiddish Book Center and running off at Rosenfarb. I did find out a little bit more over the years, but when I was young, being Jewish meant being other, which has its values and has its truths as well.
Jeff Charlotte is our guest this hour. His new book is Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. Because we're on the radio now, we need to talk about Clear Channel, and we will do that when we return and take a couple more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take another phone call. Kelly in River Falls. Hi, Kelly.
Well, good morning. I just wanted to let everybody know that Dr. Cornel West will be speaking at the Alliant Energy Center on Saturday as part of Fighting Bob Fest, and I think we're real lucky to have him. But on the subject, you know, you're talking about as time has passed him by, it seems like we have a lot of issues yet with race and class and social justice. So I think the time is right for Cornel West to make himself heard. But I had a question when you were talking about ego before. You know, Cornell is quite an educated man, and this has done a lot. Could you compare and contrast ego as relates maybe to Cornel West and compare and contrast to, say, a Sarah Palin, who really doesn't have any credentials or qualifications?
Well, to clarify, I like Cornel West. You can probably guess from my comments that I'm not a Palin supporter. And to clarify, too, I don't want to say that his time has passed. I said he was and he would say this, too. We had long conversations about this. He was he prepared himself for a movement that didn't come. That's the tragedy that we all live with, that America turned away, you know, from its better self or even the hope of its better self. We lived through an ice age of reaction, and we're not out yet by any means. So it's Cornell's time, but I would emphasize, and I think Cornell would too, it's your time and it's my time. This is this is something that the everyday people put forward. I would also add, and sort of talking about Cornell's ego, I also have an ego. You do too. That this is part of one of the, you know, I come to this from you mentioned the title of my first book called Killing the Buddha, which is this old Buddhist idea. Monk is going down the road, and he thinks he encounters the Buddha, enlightenment, nirvana. And this is the big payoff. So he rushes back to tell his teacher, Lin Chi, this very sage monk, about his, I met Buddha. And Lin Chi, as the story goes, takes a puff of his pipe and thinks about it for a minute and reaches out and smacks the guy. And says, you fool. He says, you meet the Buddha on the road, you kill him. Because the Buddha that you meet is not the real thing. It's only an expression of your longings. Well, we're all subject to that. We're all subject to ego. Part of what I wanted to do with my Cornel West story, because frankly, I mean, this was, you know, I just love this person. And I, immersing myself in his books over this long period and his ideas and so on, I wanted to humanize him. I wanted to remind people out there, especially those who say Cornel must be a saint, and whether from the left or from the right, and if he is any way deviates from that sainthood, then he's not legitimate. And that's the same thing you could say of Hava Rosenfarb, the Yiddish writer that we began by speaking with, and all these writers about the Holocaust and Elie Wiesel. You know, Hava Rosenfarb is such an interesting writer, partly one of the most important writers, is because she talks about collaboration. And I don't mean in the good sense. I mean right. In the Holocaust sense. Yeah. And she says, look, we are all collaborators. Hmm. There's nobody with clean hands here. And on that basis, then, we can go forward and think and try for something better.
Hmm. Thank you, Kelly, for the call. We only have a few minutes left, but you must tell, because we're on the radio, and I love radio, and you must tell us the clear communication story, because it has changed. Its tentacles are so wide in this country in terms of music that we hear, both on the radio, but in terms of what's played popularly. It's quite a story that we pretty much take for granted, I think.
Yeah, Clear Channel, it's this media monopoly so vast that in 1996, when Congress, under President Clinton, by the way, massively deregulated media, they couldn't even imagine that a company could get this big. And the Republicans' wildest dreams, they had no imagination that a company could control this much media. And it's just this great big monster. People had been writing about it. And, you know, you do interviews with the top guys, or you say it's terrible, terrible. I approached writing about it the same way I do writing about religion, which is I wanted to encounter the everyday experience of it. So I sort of wandered the margins. I talked to some of the top people. I drove around Oklahoma with former Congressman J.C. Watts, right-wing congressman on their board of directors, who listening to Clear Channel stations. And
but who gets how much money does he get for a board appearance? I read that and said, oh, my gosh, this is unbelievable. It's a huge amount of money.
I think it was, I think it was $100,000.
For one board meeting, yeah.
I mean, this is corporate America. But, you know, characters that I really liked more, there's some David figures who are taking on the Goliath, but then there's a guy named Brian Dilworth in Philadelphia, and he's a super cool indie rock promoter. So cool, in fact, that when I wrote this, a lot of the supporters in the Philadelphia indie rock scene said I was a villain. How dare I say he works for Clear Channel? Well, his check comes from Clear Channel. His email address is Clear Channel. He works for Clear Channel. But if I could just maybe we have time just to read one paragraph here, this passage at the end of Dilworth. He and I are walking through South Philly where he lives, which is, if you've never been, it's a very Italian neighborhood. It is one of the last preserves of absolute localism. It is not – there's no place like it anywhere else. This place is this place, as he says. And he's looking at it and he's admiring it. And he says, look, he's not a bad guy. He's making his peace, and it's a complicated peace. He says, I just wanted to make money doing something I liked. There are different opinions about how far down the road America is business-wise, but dude, whatever, it's too far gone for anything to change. So it's kind of cynical. He bumped the stroller. He's pushing his baby. So his stroller up over a curb, and the baby began to cry. We walked without talking for a few blocks, the clackety-clack of skateboard wheels fading behind us. But closer to home, both he and the baby mellowed. Dilworth stopped smiling, and his eyes stopped squinting. Then, he said, there's that feeling in your spine, and it's all right. His voice went up in pitch and grew soft, as if he were embarrassed. He was talking about rock. When the arc is just starting to arc, and you're saying, this could be Van Halen, this could be Neil Young, it's like you're bearing witness. It's not, cha-ching, here we go. It's, I saw it. It does exist. There's something really there. It's not just a need for chaos. It's, yeah, that's what I want. His voice deepened again, and his pace evened out. The baby had nodded off. We stopped in front of Dilworth's stoop. Clear Channel, he said. That's money. I need it to buy liquor and baby clothes.
There you go. Oh, my gosh. We could examine that for hours. Jeff Charlotte, our guest, the new book is Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and This Country in Between. You'll be absorbed into many different stories. Thank you, Jeff, for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for production and Chrissy Pease for on-air producing. Thanks for listening.